The Virtual Curbside is a production of the Utah Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Utah AAP, working together to improve children's lives through education, advocacy, and networking. Hi, this is Paul Workus from the Utah AAP. Welcome to this week's edition of the Virtual Curbside, where we bring pediatric providers together with subspecialists to get smarter about all things pediatric and better acquainted as a community of caregivers.
Welcome back to the Virtual Curbside. We've been fortunate this month to be able to spend some time with Dr. Justin Wheeler from the Pediatric Gastroenterology Department of Primary Children's. Welcome back, Justin.
Yeah, thanks for having me back.
Thanks so much for your time and thanks for sharing your expertise. Have you developed any major conflicts since we last talked?
No conflicts of interest.
You ever wish you had conflicts of interest? Do you think it would simplify or make your life harder if you had conflicts of interest?
I think every doctor wishes secretly that they had at least a few.
They wish secretly or they wish they had secret conflicts of interest or both.
I think they secretly wish, yes.
And there's a chance where you may discuss some off-label medication recommendations this week. Given that this is pediatric, the chances of that are at least 93% on any given.
Correct. Yeah. Correct.
Constipation, boy, constipation, that's a topic. And it's a pervasive problem, isn't it? There are a whole lot more people who are constipated than you would think.
Absolutely. I think one of the things I tell the families that come in to, that I see in my gastroenterology clinic is that being constipated is much more common than having a broken arm or something like that. But everyone talks about the kid with the broken arm in the class and no one wants to talk about constipation. So I reassure all these kids that they're not the only ones.
Right. I always tell kids there are at least a couple more kids in your class, trust me, that are having the same misery you do.
Absolutely. And I think sometimes for kids that's reassuring because no one likes to talk about poop, parents included. And oftentimes kids are very private about their bowel habits and they don't want to discuss it. So pulling that information out of your patient might be challenge number one. And then getting him feeling better could be challenge number two.
There's a 5-year-old in me that says challenge number two is exactly what we're talking about today. Are there criteria for defining constipation?
Yeah, good question. So one of the things that I talk about with my patients is that everyone has a different definition in their head. What is constipation? Infrequent, painful, or sensation of incomplete evacuation could all be defined as constipation. So everyone in their mind has a definition of what is normal. And so dragging that out of a patient is really important. I've had children who say, how's your bowel movements? They're normal. And you say, well, let's dig into that a little further. And so you start asking more questions and they stool once every 10 days. And for them, that's been their lifelong norm. And that is probably not normal. We usually say in infants that the norm or what is normal could be anywhere from 7 bowel movements a day in a breastfed infant every time they eat could be all the way to once every 7 days potentially. And in an infant that could be normal. So the things we usually talk about is an infrequent, painful bowel movements that or the sensation of incomplete evacuation.
And what are the consequences of someone being constipated? Because there can be a lot of consequences.
Right. Abdominal pain is one thing. We talked about that previously, but you can have belly pain. But in addition to that, it can decrease appetite. Kids might not want to eat. You can get nausea. When kids are backed up and constipated, it actually slows gastric emptying. So you have a gastrocolic reflux is what it's called. And when there's nowhere for stuff to move down the pipes, it just sits there and kids might vomit. It can also lead to long-term consequences. So my sub-specialty is I'm a neurogastroenterologist or motility provider, and I see kids who have the worst constipation with a very large, as consequences of chronic constipation, they get a very large and dilated rectum or sigmoid where they might start to lose sensation of needing to stool, and they might even start having fecal incontinence, something we call encopresis, and that can be devastating for a family and for a child, for their self-confidence, and then getting them feeling better can take a long time. So ignoring the problem is not the answer.
We should probably take a brief side jaunt. There are a couple of things that aren't constipation. One thing, as a general pediatrician, I hear a lot about are infants with straining with stool. Tell us a little bit about infant dyschezia.
Sure.
Besides, it's a fancy word.
Yeah, dyschezia just means painful stooling. Another term that I use sometimes is infant dysinergia. So children, babies who are trying to poop, it doesn't always come naturally. And oftentimes kids or infants, and we actually see it in older kids sometimes, they'll be pushing on the gas and the brake at the same time, where they're trying to stool and they're straining and they might turn bright red in the face and they look miserable and it's really disquieting for a parent. And they'll struggle and strain and finally they'll get poop out. But when that poop comes out, it's soft. That's what infant dyschezia or infant dysinergia is children are struggling to poop, but they can, and it's because they're tightening their anal sphincter muscles while bearing down.
And that doesn't need the same sort of intervention as constipation.
Correct. And that would be different than constipation. And sometimes parents worry that the child is constipated, and they might discover that they can do little tricks to get the kid to poop easier. Things like rectal stimulation. So you might, they notice that they stick a thermometer in the kid when they're doing that, a rectal thermometer, or use a digit, and the child will then stool. And what they're doing is they're taking advantage of something called the rectal anal inhibitory reflex, something that will relax the rectum when it's distended a little bit, or relax the anus when the rectum is distended a small amount or stimulated. The child will stool. The problem with doing that consistently in infants is that they can become dependent on that signal, and they'll only stool when they get rectal stimulation. So we typically try and avoid using rectal stimulation in those situations, and instead we focus on reassurance for families, doing things like bicycling the legs to help the child relax. And as long as the stool is soft when it comes out, giving the child time to learn those skills on their own, maybe, you know, prop them up or things like that is probably the best intervention we can do.
And how can we know that we're not dealing with something more serious like Hirschsprung's disease?
Yeah, good question. So asking, taking a good detailed history is probably the first thing you can do. If a child passes a meconium, that dark tarry stool, in the first 24 hours of life without any difficulty, the likelihood of Hirschsprung's is significantly lower. It's really quite low. And especially if they stool normally for a period of time and then they start developing that dyschezia or painful stooling or infant dysinergia, you see that develop later, that could be really reassuring. If a kiddo will only stool with rectal stimulation and it's been there since birth, that would be a red flag. That would be concerning for something like Hirschsprung's disease.
Are there some people who are just wired to be more physiologically prone to constipation?
Unfortunately, yes. So you'll see patients and it'll be a long family history of slow poopers. And there are individuals we found that have slow transit constipation. Just like some people can run a mile really, really fast, some people, unfortunately, can't run the mile quite as fast as the other people. Colons are the same. Some colons just move more slowly, and you might be predisposed to constipation.
Are there some junctures in a life or some experiences that predispose to constipation?
The big moments we see is anytime you change diet in infants or changes in routine. So introduction of solids or transitioning from breastfeeding to formula feeding, those could be, you might see changes then where the stool characteristic will change and then a child might hold onto their stool a little bit more because it's a new frightening experience, or their GI tract just slows down a little bit. So introduction of solids, toilet training is a huge one, or three, and then going to school is another one.
Sure, because they have to hold on longer. And do they just get more accustomed to the sensation of fullness and inhibit then the evacuation reflex?
I think your question is like, how does it get so bad? How do children start getting constipated? So if it is a withholding pattern, yes. You know, as humans, you have the sensation needing to stool when the rectum gets distended to a certain point, full poop. And it is culturally and socially important that you don't immediately defecate when you have that sensation. And so, yes, as humans, we have the ability to hold on until it's more appropriate. Probably lends a survival benefit too, you know, to maybe like cover your tracks to some degree. So yeah, children learn that they can withhold and that the urge will go away after 5 to 15 minutes, and they go on their way and they essentially kick the can down the road. And unfortunately, it can lead, if they don't respond to what I call nature's call, then it can start getting into trouble. Stools get hard and painful and it could be a vicious cycle.
In terms of treating constipation, does the length of time that someone's been constipated have an effect on how you approach it?
It does, yes. So if it's a first-time approach, you know, child comes in, they're a little constipated, they might respond beautifully to just dietary change, increasing liquids in their diet if that's been a change, or adding fiber, or using a stool softener like polyethylene glycol or lactulose. Other children, you know, if it's been going on for quite a while, they will have a distended and dilated rectum. And sometimes stool softeners alone will not cut it. That's maybe what I see oftentimes in my motility clinic, or children who have failed stool softeners. And probably 80 or 90% of children will respond beautifully to those. But there's a subset where it's been going on so long, they just won't respond to a stool softener. I call them mushers. And if they don't respond to the mushers, then we got to bring in the pushers. So stimulant laxatives oftentimes can be really beneficial for some patients to treat their constipation.
Do you have advice? So you've mentioned that in the little kids, you don't generally recommend something like glycerin suppositories or a thermometer or something. What about the issue of using things like suppositories or enemas in kids who are constipated? Do you use those very often?
I think they're good rescue devices. They're not good maintenance interventions. You know, they're not good medicines to use really frequently in most kids. I have a daughter, we were on vacation once, she got really backed up. And as a pediatric gastroenterologist, I was kind of banging my head against the wall, wondering how could this happen to me? You know, she wasn't responding to any of the medicines and ultimately responded to suppository. And hooray, things were great after that. It's good to have a backup plan if a kid goes on vacation and they just get out of whack. But every day, it's not necessarily what you want to use as your mainstay. And the reason why is it can be traumatic for kids to have those medications applied. It can be embarrassing as they get older. And if we can control it with oral medications, that's, you know, take away that fear factor and the trauma, it's better to use an oral medicine if possible.
Okay, so now in dealing with somebody who has been constipated for a while, how do you approach just getting them emptied out? What do you recommend?
A clean out is...
These are the ones who aren't musher candidates. These are pusher candidates.
Right. Oftentimes, any child who's really constipated, at least in the pediatric clinics or the GI clinics, we usually start with a clean out. So you use high doses of either magnesium citrate, polyethylene glycol is probably what we use most often, mixed in a sports drink that has electrolytes in it. And then oftentimes we use a stimulant laxative to complete the clean out. And then they move into a maintenance phase afterwards, where they're using a stool softener every day. And then if you don't have a bowel movement, then we'll often use a stimulant such as a Senna or bisacodyl before they go to bed as a rescue to kind of keep things moving, keep the colon rolling is what I tell my patients. So, and the reason why we tell them, they might say, I don't feel like I have to poop every day. But if they've been really constipated and they're losing sensation and they're passing stools that you might call a toilet clogger, they're very, very large caliber, that means that they've probably gotten to the point of having a dilated rectum and they're not going to feel that they need a stool until their rectum is really quite full. And so keeping them going every day will help the colon recover its tone and sensation. So just like after a woman gives birth, the abdomen can kind of be stretched out and it can take some time for that abdomen to tighten back up. We see the same thing with the rectum. And you just need to take that stress off of it. So pooping every day, good evacuation, keeping poops soft serve ice cream kind of consistency, mushy like oatmeal, will make that rectum be less stretched out and kind of allow it to heal. It's kind of like a cast for a broken leg. You just can't put a cast on the colon, right? So we need to just take the stress away, let the sensation come back, and let kids get, you know, more used to sitting on the toilet, evacuating every day, and address maybe the behavioral aspect of things.
Do you use a one-size-fits-all clean out, or is this practitioner dependent? Is it patient dependent, or a little bit of both?
No, at Primary Children's, we in our division, we actually came out with a standardized approach for cleanouts. There have been bad outcomes with kids who had to do cleanouts with enemas and things like milk and molasses enemas, and so we've tried to come up with a standardized approach to treating these kids. And so it's actually available on the Primary Children's website that you can download our standardized clean out. But
we can link to that in our show notes so that people can have access to that.
Perfect. Yeah. And it's a weight-based approach and age-based. So smaller doses for younger, smaller kids. And as they get bigger, we do larger doses.
And do you use, so you said that you often use three things all at the same time?
We often use polyethylene glycol. That would be our clean out with polyethylene glycol dissolved in a sports drink.
And what's the purpose for the electrolytes there?
You know, when kids are going through a clean out, they stool a lot. We're giving them diarrhea. That's the goal. You have them right until they're having almost like clear liquid. And that would prevent maybe them losing too much of behind on their sodium or their potassium or chloride. So you can use a sports drink. You could technically do a clean out with any kind of clear liquid, but we often use something with sugar in it so they, you know, don't drop their sugars. And
And so they'll drink it.
Probably much more. Yeah.
Okay, so you use polyethylene glycol, and then is that, so you use a step-up approach, or do you use more than one thing as a standard?
In our standard clean-out, we actually will have them use polyethylene glycol for the, you know, it's kind of like an irrigation ditch where you've got a clog in the irrigation ditch. You don't just like let a little, you know, you don't just let out, throw a bucket full at a time. You got to open the culvert and let the whole water through and kind of slam it out. And so that's where the large volumes of polyethylene glycol and liquids are helpful, we find. And then on top of that, we often will use chocolate Ex-Lax or Senna, chocolate Senicides, which is a pusher, and that's to help get the colon to contract, and it helps facilitate the clean out. We often do it over 2 days is a common approach we use, and we often use a clear liquid diet. So they're not eating the regular diet on top of, they're still eating other things. They're drinking on top of their Miralax so that they're staying hydrated, but it will make things go a lot faster.
So now that you've removed the dam, how do you fix the river? What are the mushers that you use routinely, and what do you recommend?
It all comes down to family and patient preference. So some kids are just done with Miralax or polyethylene glycol by the time they get to us, and they might want to try something else, or they might be done with some other kind of medicine. So if a patient is unwilling to take a medicine, it doesn't work if it's sitting on the counter. Of course, it goes to the mouth. So you got to find a medicine that works for the family and for the patient. There's not one that's the perfect go-to. Polyethylene glycol has the least kind of negative side effects as far as taste goes and palatability. It seems to be pretty palatable. And it seems to be pretty safe in kids. There have been large studies looking at it, an ongoing study right now, actually, that the National Pediatric GI group's doing that is showing that it seems to be a very safe medicine. So
both acutely and chronically?
Correct, yeah. And they haven't shown bad outcomes even on kids who've been on this for even years. So we feel very comfortable using it to prevent bad outcomes like a large dilated colon.
I think
the benefits far outweigh the risks. And if that doesn't work, lactulose is a good one. Lactulose works well in small children. It's very cloyingly sweet, like a syrup. Kids like it, maybe more, might take it like younger infants or something. And it does cause gas and bloating a little bit, but that's another good kind of osmotic stool softener. There are chewable magnesium preparations where some companies make magnesium hydroxide in little watermelon chews that some kids will take. And that could be a good one for some kids who don't want to drink. They do make docusate, so another, it's an emollient, so it makes your stool softener comes as a liquid or as pills as well. So those are all stool softeners we can use. And then don't be afraid to use stimulant laxative. If there's one takeaway message I would want to pass on today, is that stimulant laxatives should be a part of your toolbox. Using Senna in kids who have refractory constipation is oftentimes ultimately what helps them get better. I work with the colorectal team here at Primary Children's, where we see kids with the worst of worst constipation. And we have these children go on high-dose Senna without any stool softener. So they're only on Senna preparations upwards of 2 mg/kg. So very high doses. And this ends up being really the answer for these kids who are really constipated. They need to have close follow-up, but there's been a really great study that was put out looking at kids who are like this, who need to be on a high-dose stimulant laxative for long-term, and they haven't shown that there's development of tolerance or dependence in these kids. There were studies back in the 60s looking at use of Senna in mice, and they showed that there was dependence that developed. And so there's been a hesitancy historically as providers to use Senazides, but is over the last 10 or 15 years, there have been some really great studies that haven't borne that out, and that it is a really good medicine and a good one to use in your toolbox. So don't be afraid to have your patient say, look, if the Miralax, if you didn't poop today, use that as a rescue. Have your child take a half or a square of one of those 15 milligram scented chocolates. And it might be the thing that pushes them over the edge and keeps them cruising and avoiding things getting worse and then maybe throwing in the towel.
What about behavior modification? What do you recommend to people to get kids back on track?
Usually kids, you know, the behavioral component of constipation is huge, especially in the toddlers and school age kids. The main thing you got to do is make it so it's not scary to poop and it's not painful to poop. Our job as providers is to make it so it doesn't hurt when they stool. And there's so many medicines out there that are that work very well with that. If you can get families to take them, they're not expensive. And so if we can get families to take them, we can take away the ouch factor. Once the ouch factor is gone, we just need to give those kids confidence that it's not going to be painful. And so we often will do simple interventions like a sticker chart, or if you sit on the toilet, you get a sticker, a small token economy that there's a small prize once you've reached X, Y, or Z. The younger the kid, the more immediate the prize needs to be or the reward, whether that means maybe some extra time with family or an extra screen time, but immediate reward for just sitting and trying to push out stool, maybe a little bit of extra if they actually go on the toilet. And then avoiding punishment if a child has an accident. You know, this oftentimes kids are, their colon gets so stretched out and dilated, they don't know that it's happening. And make sure that you reinforce to parents that this isn't their fault. Let's just focus on positive reinforcement. You know, kids can help clean up messes, but you don't punish necessarily. And then if they're really still struggling to sit on the toilet, to take the medicines, then using behavioral medicine providers to help work through some of those anxieties could be helpful. They give them coping mechanisms, might give them ideas of how to approach sitting on the toilet or address some of the oppositional behaviors you might see.
Yeah, because ultimately kids want to be comfortable. And so a lot of times it just involves rechanneling that and helping them feel good about a normal life function.
Right, exactly. And I often find that kids who have, it's probably the most rewarding thing as a provider to see a child who's been miserable with constipation for an extended period of time. You know, we do our fairly simple and straightforward interventions and you see them a follow-up and the child is out, they're toilet trained, they're not in pull-ups anymore. You know, a 6, 7, 8-year-old who's been incontinent, they've never really toilet trained. And to see that amazing outcome with really minimal intervention is such a boost to the families and to the kids' self-esteem. It's just a great thing to see.
Kids' self-esteem and the parents look happier. And this is one where you're really putting them back in control. And that's a wonderful thing.
Right. You know, oftentimes you'll see patients where you wonder, is there underlying disease? You know, when do I have to worry about a red flag symptom? And those would be the patients that you would probably want to refer over to a gastroenterologist for further evaluation. Because there are some children who have things where they might have a tethered cord, for example, where they start having, or they're having fecal soiling despite everything that you're doing. You know, you've done a clean out, you've done maintenance therapy, and they're still soiling. Those kids should be referred to a gastroenterologist to tell us these things. Sometimes we'll rule out underlying disease. I've had kids who've been diagnosed with constipation because they were soiling and they ended up having things like celiac disease. And so maybe thinking about that sometimes is someone comes in, you think it's constipation and they're not responding like they normally should, you know, take a step back, think, what might we be missing? Do we need to do something else than just another clean out? Just keep that in mind.
Any other tests that kids need?
You know, as a general provider, most kids don't need diagnostic testing for constipation. You know, as a motility provider, neurogastroenterologist, we do testing like anal rectal manometry in some kids who are really refractory, have really refractory constipation. And we screen for things like anal achalasia, which would be a nerve problem, a short term or Hirschsprung's or a missed Hirschsprung's disease, or dyssynergic stooling. And we can kind of establish their sensation thresholds and things like that. We'll sometimes get MRIs of their spine to look for a tethered cord in a child who's not responding well. But those kind of diagnostic workups, I think it should probably go through a gastroenterologist. I don't know that you should feel obligated to do that or as a general practitioner.
In the past, I've often seen people do imaging, like a KUB, demonstrated a lot of stool. Is that necessary?
Really good question. Abdominal x-rays give you a single snapshot in time. And usually it'll just show a lot of stool and you can kind of get that from a clinical history. I think a physical exam is probably going to get you more headway than an x-ray. So they actually recommend, I usually don't recommend x-rays for kids who were constipated. Another thing to question is a rectal exam. I've had mentors of mine who said, the only reason you wouldn't do a rectal exam is if the child doesn't have an anus or you don't have a finger. And other providers have argued against that and said, you know, a rectal exam is invasive and can be embarrassing for kids and can be traumatic. And so my general approach is that I don't always do a rectal exam. It is situation dependent. If a child is impacted with stool and you're concerned about that, then you might do that to confirm an impaction. Oftentimes, you might just feel a palpable stool mass in some of these kids in their abdomen, and maybe confirming that it's stool could be helpful to make sure you're not missing something else. Mm-hmm. But yeah, and getting imaging is not necessary, would not be first line therapy. In our clinics, we sometimes get things like contrast enemas, or we might get an x-ray to evaluate cleanouts or things like that. But typically x-rays, there's really no place in general management of constipation.
Great. Well, again, this has been very, very helpful. Is there anything else you wanted to share?
No, I think that constipation, it really is a source of misery for many, many kids. Over 50% of individuals at some point in their life have experienced constipation. So it's very, very common. And it doesn't always get better, but it often does in children. So, you know, let families know that there's going to be ups and downs when they be extra vigilant whenever there's a change in routine. If they go on vacation, if they go back to school, make sure that they're getting their stool softeners so you don't slide backward. But if you fall off the wagon, they get backed up again, know you can always repeat a clean out and get them going again.
As we talked about with functional pain last week, in many ways, this is also a management, not a cure, but you can really give kids a lot of relief.
Absolutely. And many, many kids, once you address the behavioral component, they kind of learn to cope. And even if they have slow transit, they find that if they're keeping their diet right, you know, this is something they can really manage without having to be on medicines.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much for spending the last couple of weeks with us. This has been very informative, very helpful. Nice to talk to you. For those of you who have questions, and I'm sure you all do, send your questions to questions@vcurb.com, and we'll deal with those next week. We'll look forward to talking again. Thanks so much for your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Thanks for joining us. We look forward to getting together again next time. The Virtual Curbside is available on iTunes or wherever you find your other favorite podcasts. Be sure to like us and subscribe. We want you to like us both because we're needy that way and because that will help other listeners like you find us. Check out our website, vcurb.com, for supporting materials, schedules, and other great stuff. The Virtual Curbside is an educational production of the Utah chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. The opinions expressed in this podcast, while carefully considered, are ultimately the opinions of the presenters and not necessarily of the American Academy of Pediatrics or our employers. And remember, the content of this podcast shouldn't be seen as a substitute for seeking actual personal medical care. If this is an emergency, hang up and dial 911. Otherwise, schedule a visit with a caring healthcare provider to try to get to the bottom of your concerns. None of this could happen without Elisa Stoddard, our extraordinary executive director of the Utah AAP. Many thanks to Tim Cosgrove for his help on the website and logo design. Production design and editing thanks to Phil Workus, who also composed the theme music. See you next time.